The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Enjoy ultra-fast speeds up to 10 times faster than Sky's standard broadband.
Welcome back. 51551 is our text number, Ryan at rte.ie. Now, we go to the world of preppers. These are people who prepare for the end of the world by building bunkers and stockpiling supplies. And they felt very vindicated by the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. So how big is this world of prepping for catastrophe? Well, my guest this morning is an explorer and a social and cultural geographer. His book, Bunker, Building for the End Times, is like a globe-trotting adventure, really, and takes a deep dive into fears and dread. Which are held by these so-called preppers and the fortresses they are building. Bradley Garrett, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're in good form?
Well, I survived. We're all surviving.
Yeah, that's a kind of a serious question as opposed to small talk, because when I read the introduction to the book, it makes me feel like I want to run into a bunker, because you're listing all of the things that have gone wrong in the past and all the things that could go wrong. And it almost feels like no way to live. So, you know, how do you keep your mood up while thinking about these things?
Well, I spent 3 years living with these preppers around the world, and I have to admit it, there was a lot of doom and gloom, a lot of people, you know, speculating on potential disasters that could unfold. But there was also a lot of hope, because, of course, if you don't have faith that you're going to make it through a disaster, there's no point in preparing for it. So, I learned a lot spending time with these preppers about what we can build, how we can prepare, how we can create a kind of insurance policy to be able to make it through potential disasters. And of course, when I started working on the book in 2017, I had absolutely no idea that we were headed straight towards one.
And do these preppers feel a bit vindicated by the last year and a bit?
In some ways, they were better prepared than most people. I know a number of the prepper communities that I worked with were able to retreat to their bunkers in the first few weeks and months of the pandemic, which, you know, as everyone remembers, we didn't know how it lived on surfaces. We didn't know how it traveled necessarily. And so there was a lot of uncertainty. They were able to retreat to their communities, and we can talk about what those communities look like.
Yeah,
they're pretty exceptional. But once they were in there, they could create their own bubble. And people within those communities had complementary skills, so they could assist each other in, staying inside their bubble as long as they needed to. They didn't need to go to grocery stores. You know, while the rest of us were panic shopping for water and toilet paper, they were safely waiting it out to see what was going to happen.
I want to take a little step back, just a small bit, to your own upbringing in California, which would have been a place that you would have craved safety after the experience you had in childhood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California during the 90s, which was quite a dangerous time. There was a lot of crime. And I realized in hindsight that I actually had friends whose parents were what we call survivalists now, or what we called survivalists then. Now we call them preppers. But they were stockpiling supplies. They were building bug out bags, you know, a bag that you could take with you on the road at any moment.
Right.
And they were sort of practicing getting out of the city in case, social tensions came to a boiling point. And so I had sort of experienced some of this culture without knowing it, really. And once I started researching the topic, I suddenly had the realization that I had been around preppers my entire life.
Because you obviously in your childhood, it would have been just normal to you. And when did it become clear to you that the kind of the danger you were growing up around wasn't normal?
Well, I guess when I moved to the UK in 2008 to do my PhD, and I remember having conversations with friends at pubs about, getting beat up on the streets and having friends murdered and, seeing the shock register in people's faces. They didn't, that wasn't an experience that they had in their childhood. So, I guess there was always probably some part of me that was seeking safe space, or seeking to put in place some control over the parameters of my existence. And, that I guess that's part of the reason why I was able to identify with these preppers and what they were telling me.
Is that why you may have spent a couple of years writing this book, basically traveling bunker to bunker all around the world?
Yeah, I went to four continents and interviewed at least 100 people for this book. I visited some of the most extravagant private subterranean citadels in the world. It was, I guess initially I just thought it was kind of, you know, as a geographer, I thought it was a quirky, interesting topic about how people change space and control space and produce space. But the more time I spent with those preppers, the more I realized there were some practical lessons that were actually worth getting into the book to pass on to people. And that's, you know, that was the goal eventually.
Because we kind of associate the bunkers with the kind of Cold War period, the nuclear, the nuclear fears of the 60s, and there was going to be a nuclear shelter. And that's what probably we might associate with them. I was very surprised at how many bunkers there are all around the world. Because America had a very specific way where the government was telling people, we're not going to build one for you, you're going to have to do it yourself.
Well, that also took place in Ireland. The government here, just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, constructed a bunker in the middle of the country that was...
Athlone.
Athlone, yeah, exactly. That was for government officials, essentially. But there were small-scale bunkers that were meant to maintain the communication network. The thing about the bunkers here is that a direct nuclear attack probably wasn't on the table for Ireland. So the concern here would have been nuclear fallout from a strike on London.
And how big is that bunker? It's still there in Athlone.
It's still there. Yeah, it's been decommissioned, and I think they've stripped out all of the infrastructure. I mean, at one point it still had the kitchens. There were RTE broadcasting facilities inside the bunker.
Well, they were planning to move the government in the event of a catastrophe to Athlone, which would become the new capital of Ireland, which they'd be delighted to hear.
That's right. Yeah,
and RTE would have to broadcast live from there, State of the Nation addresses or whatever by the Taoiseach and so on.
Yeah. Well, the
fairly advanced,
you know, radio broadcasting facilities sometimes feel like a bunker already. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you'd love our bunker in Radio One. And so that's in Ireland. That'd be a pretty small one compared to someone you've seen. I mean, Switzerland are pretty well prepared, aren't they?
Yeah, Switzerland, probably the most prepared country on earth. They've got underground hardened bunker space for 110% of the population. Which is very interesting. I guess they just maybe, you know, if they assume...
Which is over 8 million people.
Over 8 million people,
they can fit into their bunker.
Yeah. A lot of them are infrastructural spaces, like the undersides of road bridges and things that they've just adapted so they can close off a door, and they've got nuclear, biological and chemical air filtration. But yeah, they can house the entire population of the country and then some.
Wow, and anywhere else in Europe that has the? Because I'm sure Britain has one.
Well, yes and no. There are probably bunkers that we don't know about.
Really?
There are some bunkers from the Cold War that have been decommissioned, and those details have been released. I opened the book with an exploration of what was the largest Cold War bunker that the UK built in underneath Wiltshire. It's called Burlington. Mm-hmm. An incredible facility with 60 miles of roads. Again, radio broadcasting facilities, kitchens, a reservoir where they can pull drinking water. And what was most interesting was a library that was still stocked, that had every book, map, diagram that you would need to reconstruct the UK in the event of an all-out nuclear Armageddon.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is that we've moved on, as you mentioned, from that kind of Cold War scenario where we're thinking about a specific threat, and we've moved on from it being solely the realm of the government to make these preparations.
Yes.
And primarily what Bunker is about the thriving private market that is now emerging. And a lot of that is about reappropriating some of that Cold War architecture and trying to turn it into a commercial real estate enterprise, which I think speaks volumes about the dread that everyone's feeling about our current situation.
Yeah, and it is quite an American phenomenon, this in particular, isn't it? Because you have this amazing statistic, I think it's from 2012, up to 40% of Americans think building a bomb shelter is a wiser investment than saving for a retirement, a peaceful retirement.
That's right, yeah. And currently, almost 13 million Americans are prepared to make it through 30 days without any sort of infrastructure, without grocery stores, food, water, electricity. That's an astounding statistic. Yeah, it was 13 million people. A lot of that stems from people's loss of faith in the government to be able to protect them in the event of a disaster, which is also was also reflected in the response of United States citizens to the COVID pandemic.
And you met some of these interesting characters. Tell us about the X Project.
Oh, the X Point. Yeah.
The X Point. Yeah. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. So I met a California real estate developer named Robert Vecino, and he was leasing these ex-government bunkers that were built during World War II, actually. It was a munitions storage depot. Mm. And the U.S. government built 575 concrete igloos that were spaced over an area about three-quarters of the size of Manhattan, a huge area in the middle of South Dakota.
Which he says is the safest place.
And he says this is the safest place on Earth. So he calls it the X Point, and he says it's the point from which humanity is going to reemerge after the next great calamity. And he's been moving families into these bunkers. So there are about 40 families living in there now, and eventually he would like to fill all 575 of those bunkers with thousands of people. And I was able to spend about a month there over the course of a couple of years watching people move into these empty concrete shells and turn them into actually quite a beautiful little neighborhood.
Some of them are preparing them for when they might need them, but others are actually living there now.
Yeah, some people are living there full time. I think they're not supposed to be because it's leased government land.
But I found it quite sad because it's part of the gigantic paranoia that some of the preppers seem to suffer from. And they've obviously, you know, fallen foul or they've fallen into the arms of conspiracy theories, a lot of them. And some of the stuff, even the guy that you were speaking to who's selling these bunkers, you know, he spouted a whole load of propagandist nonsense, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And in the book, I try to separate the preppers from who I call from the dread merchants, and Vecino is one of these that I call the dread merchants. It's obviously in their interest to stoke people's fears, to get them to buy into the bunker spaces that they're selling. But a lot of the preppers that I met that were moving into these communities were quite reasonable, rational, normal people. They just they felt that, you know, if they had a bit of disposable income, it made more sense to them rather than buying, you know, a caravan or a boat or something, you know, that they would spend money on a bunker that would be their holiday space, but would also double as an insurance policy in case things went terribly wrong.
And they do expect things to go terribly wrong. What does 72 hours to animal mean? This is a slogan the preppers use a lot.
72 hours to animal. Yeah, it's essentially the idea that if grocery stores closed, if food wasn't delivered, if the taps turned off, if the electricity stopped, it would take about 72 hours for everyone to just go completely feral. And, you know, we all had a taste of this over the past couple of years. It felt a little close, didn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if the grocery stores had shut their doors, that kind of would have, you know, we would have gone down a very bad path. And you can imagine that if the fatality rate from COVID was a bit higher, it would have taken a lot to get people to go into work to do those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen looting when things go like a natural disasters or worse in some cities, but it's always a minority, isn't it? It's always a small group.
It is, yeah. But I think it wouldn't. I agree with the preppers in that it wouldn't take much for that to expand. And one of them told me that, you know, they have no desire to take from their neighbors or, you know, to create more friction in the world. But they did want to turn themselves into a bit of a hard target, you know. So if looting was taking place, they want people to go for the grocery store, not for their house.
You went to the wealthy, obviously the wealthy elite who are flying off into space and so on at the moment. Yeah. They are thinking of the super bunkers. That industry now exists for them, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. The most extravagant bunker that I visited was in Kansas. Real estate developer called Larry Hall purchased an Atlas F nuclear missile silo from the U.S. government. This was a decommissioned missile silo. It's about 60 meters deep, and he pumped water out of this missile silo. Obviously, the missile is no longer in it. He pumped water out of the silo, and he turned it into a subterranean condominium complex I call it a geoscraper in the book, sort of the opposite of a skyscraper.
I thought it was an interesting term because you just literally picture a skyscraper that goes in the opposite direction.
Exactly. Yeah. So as you descend into the earth, you're moving through floors of people's condos. And he was selling half floor condos for $1.5 million and full floor condos for $3 million. And they sold out within months.
Wow.
He's got 57 people in there now with space. And they're also recreational facilities. He's got a shooting range, a swimming pool with a waterfall, a cinema, a bar. I'm not sure the bar is a great idea if everyone's locked in there for a long time. But he told me that those things are not luxuries, that if you're thinking about staying underground for a significant amount of time, the distraction is necessary to maintain social order within the bunker. And he was very clear about the fact that he was going to be the one who was going to maintain social order.
And how long would they be able to survive without having to surface again?
Five years.
5 years. That's incredible, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So I began to think about a lot of the bunkers that I was seeing in terms of time rather than space. So when you construct the bunker, you're always thinking about how long you might need to stay down there.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of nuclear fallout, for instance, you'd be looking at 14 days. That's when the radiation levels will fall to, you know, a relatively safe point and you can emerge from the bunker. But, you know, with the pandemic, you know, feasibly, you could have stayed down there for 2 years and just avoided the entire situation.
But since it took a while to figure out what COVID-19 and how it was going about the place. I mean, it was effectively dirty air. So the bunker isn't worth anything if you suddenly find an infected person among you and everyone's going to get infected eventually.
Well, and that's where the mechanisms of control come in, because the developer of the bunker would say in order to maintain its biological integrity, no one can enter or leave. And that's a decision. I mean, you know, who makes that decision, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. As you say, dread merchants is the way you put it. Donald Trump, he has his own private bunker down in Mar-a-Lago.
He does, yeah. My theory is that part of the reason he spent so much time at Mar-a-Lago during the, you know, the early days of his presidency, which were quite shaky, was because he wanted access to his private bunker. He didn't trust the bunker under the White House, and he didn't trust the officials around him to protect him. And so he spent.
Or vegetables. He doesn't trust those either.
He doesn't. Yeah, exactly. But I think he spent somewhere in the realm of $100,000 fixing up the bunker under Mar-a-Lago, which was also a Cold War bunker.
And I didn't know this, but he actually made some very significant decisions while down in his private bunker as president.
He did, yeah. He ordered some airstrikes. He had significant meetings in that bunker, which, you know, can be seen as problematic. You know, that's his
paranoid man.
That's his private space.
A lot of this, and the people you meet, the preppers, it's a very male pastime, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It certainly seems to be something that men are drawn to. Maybe it, you know, appeases to their masculinity, you know, the idea that they're going to be able to protect their families. A lot of them also just see it as a kind of enhanced man shed. You know, it's a kind of a place where they can hide and their phone doesn't work and they can work on projects in their bunker.
But some psychologists would probably say as well, it's this kind of fantasy of returning to the womb for some men.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the bunker, I mean, if you think about the bunker as a space that you're reborn from, it is a womb, because if you're not reborn from it, it becomes a tomb.
There's a subway in a bunker somewhere.
There is.
Colorado.
Colorado. Yeah. Oh.
Subway, as in the sandwich shop.
Oh, the sandwich shop. Yeah. I was thinking of a metro train, system, okay. There are also metro systems.
You're too long out of America.
Yeah. the Raven Rock Bunker in Pennsylvania is essentially an underground city, and it has a Subway sandwich restaurant inside the bunker, which, you know, if you're one of you get that duty as the Subway sandwich worker, yeah, you're going to be the luckiest person in the world in the event of a nuclear war.
This bunker business sounds like the hospitality industry in Ireland at the moment, that you're going to have to do many, many different jobs. There are different reasons around the world. Obviously, nuclear is the one in the 60s, and there's kind of various end of world scenarios and catastrophes they have in there. In Australia, where you went to bunkers there, they obviously are very specific about what they're preparing for.
Yeah, both Australia and California and the Western United States, where I'm from, are obviously, you know, thinking more and more about how to deal with wildfires. and as a result of the climate crisis. And, you know, there are two scenarios which align with what preppers had been telling me. You either bug in or you bug out. Now, in California, people often
bug out is obviously to
get out of Dodge. Yeah, you get out of the situation. So in California, that's often what people will do because they have vehicles, large vehicles that they can load up, and often they have multiple escape routes. In Australia, people have been building fire bunkers.
Yeah.
So you can buy one of these for about $25,000 Australian dollars, and they are airtight. They're sealed, so and they have an oxygen supply inside the bunker. So essentially, what you have there in these bushfires are hot, fast burning fires. And the idea is that if you know when the fire is getting close and you are not able to evacuate in time, you get into your bunker, you close the hatch, and you wait it out for an hour while the fire burns over you. And some people have put them into use, unfortunately.
Would they have connections to the outside world to find out if the fire is coming to an end or anything when they're down there?
I don't know.
Someone's asking, to radio broadcasts when no one has radios anymore, only smartphones, which will surely go down.
They'll go dead. And also, getting signal underground is very unlikely. Some people do have ham radios and CB radios that they use.
I want to ask you about Chernobyl because you finish the book and to go to a place where it looked like the end, it literally looks like the end of the world has already happened with that Chernobyl disaster in 1986.
Yeah, one of the questions that the preppers were never very good at answering was what happens when you come out of the bunker?
Yes.
What kind of world do you encounter and what do you do with yourself and your family? What do you go to find? And so someone suggested to me at some point, well, you know, you can go to the post-apocalyptic world. It's Chernobyl. So I went and I spent 4 days without permission sneaking into the zone and came within about 3 kilometers of the exploded nuclear reactor number 4 and was able to see the new sarcophagus that they had recently built over it. But what I found there was very interesting. It was the world without us, and it was thriving. There were fruit trees and animals everywhere. We saw moose and elk and wolves. It's sort of, you know, being repopulated because human beings aren't there destroying the environment.
Yeah, where humans aren't there. And we saw little snatches of that, didn't we, in the early days of the pandemic and lockdowns where animals started reclaiming empty streets and they just appeared within a few days of us, of the humans disappearing.
Well, it's a humbling message. You know, if there were to be a terrible calamity that wiped all of us out, the world really wouldn't care.
Yeah, it might be quite happy about things.
Yeah.
Did you in the end kind of look at the preppers and think, why prepare for catastrophe? Well, maybe they could put all their resources and energy into preventing a catastrophe such as climate change, which is still preventable for at least another maybe decade or two.
Yeah, I understand that, but I also feel like there are so many things that we encounter that are out of our hands, you know, things that feel like we don't have any control over, you know, runaway, unaligned artificial intelligence that might wipe us out, the climate crisis, nuclear war. These aren't necessarily things that we as individuals can avert. And so I did find preppers who were trying to mitigate.
A lot of people would say you could.
Yeah, yeah.
Denuclearization looked like it was going to be a policy for a time, and we may have that moment again. So,
well, but these things
are
not necessarily mutually exclusive. We can work on both of those things at the same time.
Exactly. Look, it's fascinating all the same. Bradley Garrett, Bunker, Building for the End Time. Someone says, I will take my chance above ground rather than descend into insanity, literally. But someone else says, it's always good to be prepared for any unexpected emergency, which is where you are very much. And
precisely.
But as an academic, you have a connection to UCD, actually, just before you go quickly.
I work. I work at the UCD Geography Department.
Great.
Which I have only spent a week in over the past 18 months, but I look forward to getting back to my office.
And Bunker, is it out now? Is it on its way?
It's out now. The paperback is actually coming out in a week.
Ah, very handy in a bunker.
Yeah.
So you don't have to carry a big hardback with you. Bradley Garrett, it's been fascinating.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
Best of luck with the book. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.